this week's parsha is Bishalach. Bishalach literally means when they were sent, when they were sent away, when they were sent out. The Torah portion begins with the statement that it was that when the Jews were sent out of Egypt by Paro, Vayihi Bishalach Paro et ha'am, when the Jews were sent out of Egypt by Paro, the Torah says that the nation, the Jews, were not led by Hashem. We'll talk about that a little bit. The very interesting first sentence of this week's parsha, which is the name of the parsha too, Bishalach. So I'll read you the sentence, and then you'll see immediately some interesting tensions in this sentence, and we'll talk about how that plays itself out over the course of the entire parsha. So the sentence says like this: Vayhi, and it was Bishalach Paro et ha'am, when Paro sent out the nation. Doesn't say the Jewish nation, says the nation. Below Nacham Elokim, God did not lead them derech eretz plishtim, the land, through the land belonging to the Plishtim people, the Plishti people. Ki karov hu, although that was closer, that was a more direct route. So the Jews were leaving Egypt. Now the Jewish nation, as you know, started in Israel. That means is that although Abraham, the first Jew, father of the Jewish nation, lived in Iraq, what's today Iraq, the land of Ur, that was what was called at that time, Ur Kastim, the Kasti place. In English, they call it Chaldean place. And Ur is either a descriptive term or it is an actual name of a city. So Abraham originally comes from place called Ur, which is pretty much Iraq today. And then Abraham's father moved to a place called Haran, and that's where Abraham lived for a while. And Haran is the border between Jordan and Iraq, somewhere in that area. And from that point, Abraham was told by Hashem, when he was 75 years old, I want you now to move permanently, to make aliyah, to move permanently to Israel. And Abraham moved to Israel when he was 75. He died, he passed away at the age of 175. So he lived in Israel for 100 years. And Yitzhak, his son, lived in Israel too. As a matter of fact, Yitzhak never left Israel. Yitzhak was born when Abraham was 100 years old. And Yitzhak lived 180 years, which means essentially that now the Jews, meaning Abraham and Yitzhak between themselves, are in Israel for 180 years. And Yaakov was born when Yitzhak was 60 years old. So we zoom back 60 years, that's 120 years. And Yaakov lived in Israel until he was 130 years old, at which point he came down to Egypt. So 120 plus 130 is 250. So for 250 years, the Jews had lived in Israel. And then there was a famine, and the Jews needed to leave Israel because there was no food. So they went down to Egypt, and they detoured in Egypt for a short trip of 210 years. And after 210 years, this is where we're up to right now, Hashem says to the Jewish people, no longer will you be in a foreign country. No longer are you going to be in Egypt. You're going to go back to your homeland, to Israel, the place that your ancestors, meaning not 400 years before that, Abraham started there, but where your nation began and Abraham began for 250 years, and you're going to go back there. So now the question was, what is the route to go back to Israel? The most direct route would have been passing through the land belonging to a nation called the Plishtim. These were the original Palestinians. So when the Palestinians today call themselves Palestinians, it's modeled after what the Roman Empire decided to rename Israel, Palestina. And the Roman Empire decided to do that because of the ancient Palestinians who were living there, Plishtim. They had nothing to do with the Arabs. They don't come from the same family at all. They were an ancient tribe that lived in Israel before even Abraham got there. And as the Torah tells us, they lost their lease on the land of Israel by Hashem. Hashem kicked them out because they were worshiping idols and they were doing all kinds of other immoral practices. So now the question is, how should the Jews go back to Israel? So the Torah says, Lo nacham Elokim derech eretz plishtim, that Hashem did not lead the Jews through the Plishti land. He karav hu, although that would have been a more direct route. He amar Elokim, because Hashem said, Pen yinachei ma'am, maybe the people are going to be having a change of heart. Bir osa milchama, when they see that there's a war involved in getting the land, because the Plishti people were very bad people. And they also were very ferocious warriors. Bishavu Mitzrayim, they're going to want to return to Egypt. So essentially, the first pasuk is a very interesting combination of concepts and almost negative statements. Hashem leads the Jews out of Egypt. Now we're a free people. So how does the story start? It doesn't start with the positive. That the Jews passed through, no, start with the negative. Why didn't we, almost as an excuse, almost as if you're giving an excuse. I'm here for your party. Why didn't I show up in a nicer, you know, outfit? Why didn't I bring a better gift? Well, because I had this thing, but I'm here for you. So, we're talking about Hashem, who is leading the Jewish people out of Israel, out of Egypt, back to Israel. Why do you have to go with the negative and say, Hashem is leading the Jews out of Egypt and we're going back to Israel, but he didn't do it in a way that's close. He did it in a way as far. So let me give you an excuse for why Hashem didn't do it in that way. Stop with the negative. Just say the positive. The Jews were slaves for 116 years. They were harshly enslaved. Hashem brought 10 plagues, and the 10 plagues were amazing miracles, each one of them on its own. And now Hashem is leading the Jews proudly back to their land. Who cares if they're not going the shortest route? Look at the positive. We're going back to Israel. The whole story is very strange, the way the Torah is telling us the story. That's question number one. Question number two is, the last few parshas we have spent talking about how Paro is stubborn. Paro is stiff-necked. Paro is not listening to Hashem's instructions through Moshe. And he doesn't want to let the people go serve Hashem. And he doesn't want to recognize Hashem's authority and so on, until Hashem has to beat him up literally and break his spirit and kill his people. And they all deserved it because they were cruel Nazis, crueler than the Nazis. So they all deserved every single thing. The Nazis perpetrated the Holocaust for, let's say, 39 to 45. 6 years, let's say, maybe 38, you want to count original stuff. This is 116 years of exact same stuff the Nazis were doing to the Jews. For 6 years, they did for 116 years. So, you know, they deserved every single thing they got plus. Nobody is upset that the Egyptians went through this thing. So now what does the Torah say? By year it was, B'shalach Paro et ha'am, when Paro sent out the nation. Are you kidding me? Paro sent out the nation? Hashem broke Paro's spirit, literally murdered, well, I shouldn't say murdered because that's a bad connotation, but killed every firstborn in every home. And Paro had absolutely no choice. And the Jews left Egypt because Hashem sent them out of Egypt. So look how the parsha starts. It was when Paro sent out the nation, Hashem didn't do the best possible way that he could have done for the Jewish people by giving them a direct route back to their homeland where they had lived for 250 years before the slavery, before the living in Egypt. And with a big fat excuse, because maybe the people are going to be upset. Stop with the negativity again. And don't talk about Paro. And don't talk about what Hashem didn't do for us. It should have said it was when Hashem concluded the 10 plagues, and the Jews were led back to Egypt, to Israel rather proudly. So this and this is what happened. So of course, you know, there's clearly a reason why Torah tells us the story this way. And the rest of the parsha is going to be a development of the answers to these questions. So therefore, we have to go a little bit further in the parsha. So the parsha says to us that when the Jews went through left and Moshe had told Hashem, the Jews that Hashem is going to remember you, and Hashem is going to take care of you, and then we have the story with the Egyptian army chasing the Jewish people, and the story with the splitting of the sea, And then after the story of the splitting of the sea and the final remains, the last 600 chariots belonging to the Egyptian army were drowned, and they all died in the splitting of the waters coming crashing back down by the splitting of the sea. After that, we have the story of the man coming down from heaven and the food that the Jewish people were given. So what we have to ask ourselves is, why were we sent out of Israel? Why did we go to Egypt, in fact? And why was it so important that Paro should agree? The 10 plagues, the process of the 10 plagues was a process where Paro had to recognize that Hashem is the boss. If Hashem wanted to take us out of Egypt, Hashem could have done it in 1 minute, given the last of the 10 plagues, or make all 10 plagues at once, similar to the story of the five cities that were going to be destroyed in the time of Abraham. And in fact, four cities were completely obliterated. And who was saved? Was saved Lot. Do you remember the story where the angels come to Lot and the whole story back in Parshas Vayera, where the story is that the cities of Sodom and Amorah are very wicked, together with another three cities. Hashem sends angels. Boom, bim, bam, boom. In 2 seconds, they turn over the whole city. Every single last person is killed and punished. Lot, the ones who needed to be saved were Lot and his family. So they're saved, plain and simple. When Hashem wants to save the Jews from Egypt, he could have done exactly the same thing. Send Moshe to Egypt. Make all 10 plagues happen in 1 minute. Hashem could have done it, obviously. And the Egyptians would have been completely decimated. And the Jews would leave, plain and simple. So what is happening here? Why do we have 10 plagues in this process? And why is it necessary for Paro to be the one to send out the Jews? And why does the Torah stress that? Vehi b'shalach Paro esam, Paro sends out the Jews. And the answer is that this goes back to the concept of the sparks that fall down from in the process of creation and the energy that Hashem scatters throughout the world, and the task of us, the Jewish people, in going out and in elevating those sparks. And this goes back to the story of creation itself and the purpose of creation itself and to Hashem's desire, almost a need to be recognized by his creations. I say almost a need because Hashem actually says, I have this need. I want to have nachas from you. I want you to fulfill the mitzvahs so that I feel good. Hashem decided that he needs to feel good. Obviously, God has no needs. But Hashem says, I am making myself needy, and I'm putting myself at your, meaning you human beings, at your mercy almost, and you can have the choice whether to make me happy or not. I'm making my happiness dependent on your choosing. No, sometimes you could have a relationship with somebody. I don't care what you choose. I don't care what you do. I just need you to do something. That's a boss-worker relationship. I don't need you to love me. I need you to show up and clean the floors. I need you to do the work, the filing work. I need you to build a house. I don't care what you think about me. But then there are relationships that are with one person puts themselves at the mercy of the other person's feelings. That's family relationships, spousal relationships, friend relationships. Say, I am making myself vulnerable to you. And Hashem tells us in the Chumash that he, in fact, wants that second kind of relationship. Hashem does not want a boss-worker relationship. And we talk about two types of relationship we have with Hashem. One is a melech, a king, and an eved, a servant, a slave. And the other one is an av, a father, and a ben, and a son. So there are two relationships we have with Hashem, king-slave relationship, or parent-child relationship. Those are two absolutely different relationships. Having said that, even the king-servant relationship has an element to it that is dependent on the servant recognizing the mastery of the king. There is no king. And if you want to know, you see this from the modern-day despots in various countries that are still exist. Or even the regular normal politicians, even if the person is on top, they still want that the population should love them, respect them, look up to them, think that they're good and kind and benevolent. They're not friends. I'm not your friend, but I want you to look up to me. I want you to think that I'm magnanimous. I'm a good politician. I'm a good dictator. You love me. All the dictators make parades for themselves and the people have to come out and they have to clap and cheer and line up and the kids from school have to come out and say poems. How wonderful this dictator is. You ask yourself, why? The guy's a dictator, so you do whatever you're wanting anyway. Well, what do you need to be? That's the way it is. That's the way it is. Hashem has made himself and set himself up the same way. That Hashem has said, I have this need. I'm making myself have this need. Obviously, as I said, doesn't really have a need because Hashem is infinite, has no needs. God has no needs. Hashem has said, I will put myself into the world. I will put myself into this box. I will make myself vulnerable to your attitudes and your feelings. And part of that process, Hashem says, is I will give you a job to do that almost I can't do myself. What do you mean almost? Hashem can do anything himself. Hashem says, I'm going to create, and in the process of the original process of creation, I'm going to make things go haywire. I'm going to make the energy scatter in different places. And then I'm going to turn to you people, and I'm going to say to you people, I need you. What do I need you to do? I need you to fix what I broke. This is incredible language coming from Hashem, God. God says to us, I need you to fix what I broke. I broke it. Now you got to fix it. You are necessary to me. Again, why Hashem did it, we don't know. This is a need that Hashem decided he wants to have. But at the end of the day, this is what we believe it happened. And this is what we, based on our traditions, based on our prophets telling us these things from the Chumash. Hashem has told us at the very beginning of the Chumash, and we say this in our Friday night Kiddush, when we make Kiddush on every Shabbos, every Friday night, we say, Asher bara Elokim la'asot, that Hashem has created in order for us to do. Hashem created the world in order for us to have a canvas, in order for us to have a place where we can make the most beautiful picture. Hashem has created the world in order for us to do things. And therefore, the Jewish nation needed to go to Egypt, because Egypt was the place of immorality, the place of idol worship, the place of black magic, the place of belief in other forces. And by us going to Egypt, we broke the source of negativity towards Hashem's unity. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. We believe Hashem is one. Paro is the antithesis, the opposite of this concept of a belief in Hashem, that Hashem is one. And the Jews had to break that. So Paro couldn't just be destroyed the way Sodom and Amorah were destroyed. Paro had to come around to actually say with his mouth, no, I'm wrong. No, you're right. I was wrong and you are right. The energy had to be redirected. Just to break down your enemy and therefore you are the winner, it just means you're stronger, but what have you really won? The winning really means that your enemy has now no longer your enemy. Now your enemy is your friend. Yes, now you've won. Otherwise, you're just a more brute force than the other person. You haven't really won, so to speak. You've put your agenda through. But to win, real winning means when your opposition is no longer opposing you, but is rather even assisting you. This is a constant theme in the Torah, and it's a constant theme ultimately in the prophets and the Nevi'im, and it's a constant theme ultimately in our davening, and this is what Mashiach is eventually going to accomplish. La'avdo kulam shechem echad, the language of, we say in the Eleinu prayer, that the nations of the world will all gather together to worship the one God all together in unison. And this process developed from the very beginning of the story of creation with Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava in Gan Eden, in paradise. They were supposed to take the snake and bring the snake over to their side. Instead, they fell into the trap of the snake. And they actually listened to the advice that's coming from the negative side instead of bringing the negative side to them. Instead of showing the negative side, the snake, which symbolizes, this was symbolic of all of the, and the opposition to Hashem's plan, that no, we're going to listen to Hashem. We're not going to eat from the tree of knowledge. We're going to follow the plan. And you're going to watch, stand by, and you're going to help us. And you're going to be, and then we'll be patient. Eventually, when Hashem tells us that we can eat from the tree of knowledge, we will. According to the Medrash, it was supposed to be at the end of the day. That was, they were created on a Friday. It was supposed to be Friday night on Shabbos. They would have eaten from the tree of knowledge. According to that Medrash, the tree of knowledge was actually grapes. And not figs, but grapes. And they were supposed to squeeze the grapes and make it into wine and make Kiddush on the wine. Whether it's metaphorical or it's actual, literal, that they were the grapes and wine, or it's just metaphorical. The idea was that they were supposed to show the negative side how to approach Hashem and not get caught up in the trap of the negative side. And not, you're not supposed to party with the bad people. You're supposed to get the bad people to party with you to elevate them. They didn't do that, and we slipped into a long, long process of trying to fix that. And eventually, Hashem chose Abraham as the one who's going to fix that. And eventually, Abraham's children went down to Egypt, where Paro himself is symbolized by the snake. We spoke about this a couple weeks ago. Paro himself calls himself the Tanin HaGadol, the great snake. Paro was the reincarnation, the re-embodiment of this snake concept, this idea of going against Hashem's plan, being having your own agenda, not listening to your creator, not going with the plan that Hashem has for the world, not giving nachas to Hashem, not making Hashem happy, misusing the trust, misusing the energy that Hashem gave you in order to show that you have power so you can turn around and pay it back. You say, oh, I have power. Okay, if I have power, I'm gonna do whatever I want. I'm not gonna listen to you. You gave me a credit card, my dear mother, my dear father. It means I can buy whatever I want. You didn't give me a credit card or a bunch of cash and send me to college so that I should listen to you. Obviously, if you gave me cash and you sent me to college, it means that I'm independent and it means I can do whatever I want. So everybody understands that this is not the way things are supposed to be. The reason a parent gives the child a line of credit or cash or credit card, whatever you want to say, is because you want the kid to use it wisely and make you proud of them, not because you now want them to do all kinds of crazy stuff with the money you're giving them. Paro says to Hashem, Hashem, you gave me Egypt. You gave me the Nile River. You made my country economically sound and superior to the countries around it. Clearly, I'm the boss. That's my logical conclusion. I must be the boss. If I'm the rich guy, I must be the boss. Instead of saying, thank you, Hashem, how can I serve you? So therefore, Paro had to be broken. And eventually we find, and the Zohar tells us this, that the word Paro itself is an allusion, a hint to this concept. Because the word Paro itself can either be wild, the word in Hebrew, the word parua is wild. We find this. In fact, this language is used in the Chumash when the Jewish nation worships the golden calf. Moshe says, I see that the Jewish nation has been made wild by this worship, meaning they are undisciplined. They're doing whatever they want. They're not listening to Hashem's plan. They're not making Hashem proud of them. They're saying, if we have riches, we're free people. Our logical conclusion must be that means we can do whatever we want to do. That's what it means, being free, right? Being free means you can do whatever you want. Instead of saying that means that we should figure out where we got this from, where we come from, what our reason in life, what our purpose is, and what really we can accomplish to make ourselves greater and not more debased. The Jews said the opposite. On the other hand, we find that the word paro, which is para, to uncover and open up, also means to open up great channels of energy. So Zohar says that there is the concept of paro that's a negative, but then there is the concept of paro that is actually opening up the channels. And it all depends how you look at your situation. Again, if you look at your situation, I have this blessing from Hashem, and therefore I'm the boss, therefore I'm great. That's the bad Paro. That's Paro who's the snake. But if you look at yourself and you say, Hashem has given me all this energy, you know what I could accomplish in the good side with all this energy? I can go out and I can do this and I can do that, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to show the world because I'm the richest guy. Everybody listens to the rich person. It's not just Fiddler on the Roof who says the rich man is always right. Everybody listens. The rich man is always, you know, people say the rich man, the rich man. So if we are the rich man, we are the Jews that control the money of the world, then we are going to show the world how to act morally, how to act spiritually, how to be better and kinder and more spiritual and more recognizing of Hashem's presence. We're going to be in the light unto the nations that we're really supposed to be, and not the opposite. So this is the Paro on the good side. And therefore the Parsha opens up, Vayhi b'shalach Paro es ha'am, when the evil part of Paro was broken and the negative side of Paro was subdued. And instead of having the negativity of Paro, the selfishness of Paro, the self-centeredness, the narcissism of Paro, and that I'm the boss and everything's for me. Instead, Bishalach Paro es ha'am. And what is the word am? Why does it say am? Because the Torah tells us, and Chassidus and Kabbalah explains, that the word am is related to the Hebrew word for humility. Hebrew word for being a humble person. There is an expression, it's Mishnaic Hebrew, but it is Hebrew, that when you have a fire that is a burning fire, you make a bonfire, campfire, and you want to cook on the campfire. So if you ever went camping, or nowadays we don't have fires like that, but it used to be everybody in their kitchen had a fire that was made out of some fuel source. So as soon as you light the fuel source, let's say a barbecue, you know, a good example is a barbecue. You take a barbecue, and the barbecue is actually charcoal or wood, and you light it. Well, what happens is that initially the flames, the fuel source is a big fire. The charcoal briquettes or the wood is burning with a very big fire. You cannot cook on that very big fire for two reasons. First of all, the flames are going to burn whatever you put on the grill. And second of all, the heat is simply not concentrated. It's not the right heat. So what do you have to do? You have to wait until the charcoal or the wood fire burns itself through and through the wood or the charcoal. And only then do the flames subside. And only then is the heat focused and concentrated. And then you could put something on the grill, and you can have the proper heat with the right amount of time, you can control it, and so on. It's a useful heat as opposed to a wild heat. So as long as the fire is burning wild, and this is the parua, the wild part of Paro, not useful. When there is a revealed heat, and the heat now has developed through the coals, through the fuel source, it's become permeated with the fire, it's burning through and through, and it's glowing now. Then you have the Paro, the opening up of the energy, meaning literally this, you know, again, modern science, not even not so modern science, we have just plain, is Hashem has given us this knowledge to understand how the world works. So we understand today that there's this concept of transferring the energy from the kinetic to the actual energy. So you've opened up, you're moving the previously dormant sleeping piece of wood, piece of charcoal. You're opening up its energy, and you're converting the mass into energy. You're converting the mass of the wood, the mass of the charcoal. You're moving it. You're opening up those channels, and you're using it now to cook your food. The same is true in the great world, in a larger sense, in the spiritual world. That's true on the micro level, true on the macro level. That our job is to approach the world and to use the world as open up the energies, the resources that there is at our disposal in the world that we come in contact with, our life, our friends, our work, whatever it is, and use them to make Hashem happy. Use them in the way Hashem wants us to use them. And that's carefully delineated and very detailed how to do it in the Torah, every single thing from waking up in the morning to how to get dressed, to what to say and what to do and how to say it and where to go, every single thing, and what kind of a house and what should be put on the doorpost of our house and what kind of food should we put in our mouth. Every single thing is delineated in our Torah. So Hashem has given us the plan. And when we follow that plan, then in fact, we open up the channel. So anyway, that's what the Torah says. V'hi b'shalach paro es ha'am. When Paro sent out the am is the Hebrew word gechalim omemot, banked coals, called banked coals in English. When the coals are no longer burning wildly, but instead they're banked, meaning they're now glowing. Now the people are able to, they're able to accomplish. V'lo nacham derech eretz plishtim. Hashem did not send us through the land of the plishtim. What is the land of the plishtim? So Kabbalah, Chassidus explains that the word plishtim comes from the word, Hebrew word called mithulash, that means open, not walled, not walled. Originally, they were called the plishti people. Why are they called the Palestinian people, the plishti people? Because in Hebrew, the word plishtim means open, and it referred to the type of cities that they lived in. So the plishti people were such mighty warriors that they did not need walls around their city. Nobody was dumb enough to try to attack them. If you are a weak person, afraid of a more powerful enemy, a robber, a more powerful army, you put up a fortress, you put up a wall, let the person have a tough time breaking through, and of course they're going to have a tough time breaking through, so you lock your house at night. But if you're the biggest ganef in town, the biggest mobster in town, you don't have to lock your doors. Nobody's coming into your house. Everybody's afraid of you. The Plishti people lived in cities that were unwalled cities because they were such tough warriors, such ferocious warriors. And in fact, we find throughout the Tanakh, up until the times of David HaMelech, of King David, that the Plishti people caused a lot of trouble to the Jews for a few hundred years until from when we entered Israel with Joshua, with Yehoshua, until the time of King David. They constantly were fighting with the Plishti people. Very, very tough enemy until King David totally subdued them for a while. But that's the story of the Plishti people. And Chassidus explains, the Kabbalah explains that the Plishti people were called the Plishti, meaning the open people, not only because they had cities that were unwalled, open cities, but because that was their attitude, that was their approach to life also. They believed that there is no guardrails. You do whatever you want. There is nothing stopping you. If you can do, you should do it. The language of King Arthur, might makes right. Might makes right. If you have the strength to do something, it means that that's the right thing for you to do. Nobody's stopping you. You can get away with it. You should do it. Live life to the fullest according to your abilities and according to what you can do with complete disregard for morality, for doing whatever. This is unfortunately what we're back stuck into, the Plishti mode today in our country, that what we in our country, and talking about United States now, in the world in general, there was a time when people were doing all kinds of bad stuff, all kinds of immoral stuff, because humanity has not changed. So immorality, thieving, raping, murdering, and pillaging, this is nothing new. But people were embarrassed. People were ashamed. Nobody would get up in public and say, this is what I do. Let alone get up in public and say, this is what I do, and I want you to give me an award for it. I want you to give me recognition for the fact that this is what I do. People were embarrassed, plain and simple. We have today reached a new low in society where people do all kinds of stuff and they say, no, I want you to give me an award because I'm different, I'm unique, give me an award for it. It's a parenthetic comment. The Torah does not like such an attitude, clearly. Hashem does not like such an attitude. The Plishti attitude is, I'm open, you're open. We're consenting adults, do whatever we want, as long as you can get away with it. Doesn't work for Hashem. Hashem says, I've given you laws. I've given you morality. I don't want you to do whatever you can do. I want you to do what I want you to do, and you should have self-control. This is a very bad word, self-control. In the Plishti lexicon, in the Paro lexicon, self-control is a terrible thing. Why should I have self-control? If I can do it, I should do it. So therefore, the exercise of the Jewish people being in Egypt was an exercise in teaching us. We had to be there for that length of time, not only to break Paro, not only to convert this negativity of Paro into positive action, but also to teach us a lesson, which we did learn it, but we kept forgetting it. And the Torah goes on and talks about, towards the end of the parsha, this week's parsha, the fact that the Jews immediately complain to Hashem that they don't have enough bread, enough water, enough this, enough that. So the lesson was learned, but imperfectly. In other words, intellectually, we learned the lesson. But to actually implement that lesson into the way we act, well, we call that cognitive dissonance. We know the right thing, but we explain away why we shouldn't do it. And this is, of course, the story of the Chumash. And all of the stories in the Torah are not just plain history stories. Torah is not a history book, even though it contains history. But that's not why the Torah was given to us. The Torah means lesson. It means an instruction. That's what the word Torah means. A teaching. It teaches us how to live our lives today. It doesn't just tell us history about yesterday, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, whatever it was. Not 2,000, but 3,000, 4,000 years ago. This is 3,335 years ago, this story that we're reading about in this week's Parsha. So that is the lesson about Paro. So the Torah tells us that Paro had to send out the nation. It wasn't enough for Hashem to break Paro. The nation had to be an Am, a nation of humility, not narcissistic, a nation humble, dedicated to a greater purpose, not just to ourselves. We were not sent through the Plishti path, because the Plishti path would have been opposite. And Hashem said, I know you people. I know that if you're going to be exposed, you're a bunch of addicts. And that's the human state. The human state is we are addicts. We are alcoholics. We are addicts. What that means is we're addicted to ourself. We're addicted to our ego. It's very difficult to put our ego in a box. If we have accomplished that, then we have to be on a guard constantly, not to slip once again into narcissism, meaning into doing what we think is right, doing what makes us happy for the moment without looking at the big picture. So Hashem said, I'm going to send you through the land of the Plishtim. Peninachei ma'am. The people are going to have a change of heart. Bir'osa milchama, when they see the war that is necessary. What war? What do you mean bir'osa milchama? They see a war. This is what the Torah is worried about. The people are going to see a war. Hashem has just broken the greatest army, Egypt. 10 plagues, complete decimation of the greatest army. It's like saying, you know, the Allied and the Axis powers and this and all together, and the Jews are going free, and everybody's now celebrating and championing the Jewish people. So, whoa, worried about a war? The answer is the war that we have to fight. When they see that it's difficult, that it's tough, you're going to expose the Jewish people to the Plishti concept, this concept of narcissistic living. Vishavu Mitzrayim, they're going to return back to the limitations of Egypt. Mitzrayim is the limitations of Egypt. They're going to just slip back into their old way of doing things, and they're not going to be the holy nation that I, Hashem, have forged over 116 years of slavery. I've made the people realize that they're not their own masters, that there's somebody else, a greater force that masters them. And now I've switched that needle to be that greater force. It's not Paro, but it's me, Hashem. So the process, and this is something that David HaMelech, King David, tells us in Tehillim, that Mitzrayim is Kur HaBarzel. Kur HaBarzel is a Hebrew word that means a smelting pot. A place where you put iron that's full of impurities, you boil it up to a very, very high temperature so the impurities melt away, and all you're left with is the pure metal. So this was the Egypt, the process of us, Jewish nation, being in Egypt was a process of refinement, not only of the world, not only, but of us, Jewish people. And now Hashem says, I got this beautiful, beautiful, pure gold people. I don't want them contaminated by having to again deal with the same issues that maybe will make them slip back. Unfortunately, unfortunately, we in fact did not live up to Hashem's expectations of us for too long. We keep going back to perfection, but we keep vacillating. We go back and forth. And this is the beginning of the parsha. The beginning of parsha, anyway, is this concept lays the foundation for these very, very important concepts. And then the parsha continues, and we talk about the splitting of the sea. And the splitting of the sea, Rashi tells us, quoting the Midrash, Ra'asa shifcha al hayam, even a maid servant from the Jewish people, meaning a person with no great knowledge or understanding, just simple maid, saw spirituality on a level mashallah ro'o hanaviyim, what the prophets did not see. Rashi, this is from Rashi quoting the Midrash, that the least perceptive Jew doesn't mean a shifcha, a maidservant. And why some maids are smarter than the masters. It means the least perceptive, a euphemism, the least perceptive Jew, the Jew that's involved with cleaning toilets, the Jew that's involved with sweeping the floor. What is a maid? A maid is a person that is involved with cleaning garbage most of the day. What do you hire a maid for? You hire a maid to clean your floor, to sweep your, to clean, do your laundry, take out the stains from your clothing, to clean your toilets, this and that. What is a maid? A maid means a person that's involved with menial stuff, stuff that is not of the higher intellectual sort. So even the least perceptive Jew, the Jew that was the most involved with materialistic pursuits, most involved with just looking at the world as a big candy store for me to enjoy myself in, was able at the splitting of the sea to see the purpose of creation, to see Hashem's energies, to see Hashem's hand in the way the world's created, in a way that even the greatest of Nevi'im, the greatest of prophets, didn't see. In other words, Hashem showed his hand at the splitting of the sea. Hashem showed us each individual Jew, still obviously according to their level, but even the lowest of those levels was greater than the greatest of the prophets. And we were able to finally, Hashem showed us the real purpose of living in life. So imagine if a person says, I'm living in the X number of years, what's it all about? And if I was here, and if I'm not here, and if I do this, and if I don't do this, and if I take this path, who cares? What's the difference? What difference do I make? Who cares about me? And what should I really be doing? Or maybe a person is even thinking of that existentially. Maybe a person is just plain going about their life, just enjoying themselves. Then, and one day, all of a sudden, you have a flash of inspiration, an epiphany, a flash of inspiration, and you realize that, no, you make the most difference in somebody's life, and no, you're here for a reason, and all of a sudden, your whole world lights up. That's the splitting of the sea. Hashem took away the masks. Hashem took away the cover-up, and we were able at that point for a very short period in time to actually see not only the purpose of life, but also our place in that plan, how we contribute to that plan happening. And what happens when that happens? You're the happiest you can ever be. That's why the people sang the song at the sea, which is this week's parsha, this song at the sea, as Yashir. So this is the parsha. The story of the parsha is Hashem is teaching us that leaving Egypt doesn't just mean going free and doing whatever you want. Real happiness, real joy comes from knowing your purpose. First of all, feeling that you have a sense of purpose and that you're not just an accident. And second of all, knowing what your goals and what your purpose should be. And third of all, realizing that you're actually fulfilling that purpose and you're actually making that difference. And then a person is amazingly happy. A person is amazingly content and satisfied. There's nothing that can make you angry. Nothing can make you upset. If you are feel that you're absolutely, you go through any trial, any tribulation, any kind of thing. If I know the whole world is depending on me, and I'm really, really holding up something very important, then you're able to go to work even though it's difficult. You're able to take care of your kids even though it's difficult. You're able to do whatever it is because I'm doing such amazing, incredible. You have such a sense of self-worth. that it's really incredible. So therefore, this parsha is very, very energizing, very uplifting parsha. And in fact, this Shabbos is called Shabbos Shira. The entire Shabbos is called, not Shabbos Parshas B'Shalach, which is, of course, what it's called also, Shabbos of the, but the Shabbos is given its different name. It's called Shabbos Shira, the Shabbos of song, because this Shabbos makes us so excited about our life, so excited about our mission, and so excited about our place in the timeline of history and where we are today, right at the beginning of the coming of Mashiach, right at the moment when Mashiach is about to announce, hey guys, the difficult times are up and we're going right back to Israel, right back to the Beis HaMikdash. This is Shabbos Shira. So it's a very special Shabbos. And as you know, we celebrated also yesterday the 10th of Shvat, which is the anniversary of the previous Rebbe's Yahrzeit in 1950 and the Rebbe becoming the Rebbe in 1951. And a lot of energies. And next week, we're going to have the 15th day of Shvat on Monday, Sunday night and Monday. And the 15th day of Shvat is a rejuvenation of all of the trees, the Rosh Hashanah for trees. It was the beginning of the new energy that comes into trees. And the idea that the Jewish nation is compared to fruit that comes from the tree. And our job is to produce that fruit and to realize that in order to produce proper fruit, you have to have a tree that's firmly planted in the earth. And you have to have nourishment going through your roots, coming from your roots through the tree up to producing. So we got to be connected to Hashem's plan. We have to allow that plan to permeate and to flow through every one of our branches, every part of our actions, of our mental capacities and our emotional capacities and our day, every minute of our day. So this is very energizing stuff. So anybody has anything they want to add or ask or contribute, please feel free.
Rabbi, is there a significance of Abraham going to Pharaoh, then the Jewish nation going to, Moses taking Jews from Pharaoh? Like why does it like keep repeating? Like, is it, was it like, did you want it to play it first? Or, and you know, Pharaoh is the incarnation of snake.
Right, exactly. I mean, all the same idea, the same idea. We have to open up Pharaoh. Well, it's interesting that later on, after the Jews leave Egypt, the Torah tells us that Paro was done. That's it, finished. Paro is done. The center of opposition to spirituality moved from Egypt. It moved to other places. It moved to Babylon, it moved to Persia, it moved to Rome. But Paro was done. That's it. We wiped out whatever negativity was in the center called Paro, in that center, and we moved on to other sectors to fix other sectors. But what Abraham started by going down to Egypt, and then Yaakov, of course, who went down to Egypt and built a yeshiva there first, and then the Jews who were slaves in Egypt, and then Moshe who went down to Paro, that eventually was finished. That whole line was done. And as a matter of fact, one of the mitzvahs in the Torah is that we should never go back to Egypt. We should never live in Egypt permanently if we can help it. Rambam, very famously, who lived in actually Alexandria in Egypt, many of his letters that he signs, he says, this is Moshe, the son of Maimon, who is violating, these mitzvahs every day by living in Egypt. He had no choice. He had to run away from the Muslims who were murdering people left and right, the Almohads. He was living in Cordoba, Spain, but he had to run away. So he had no choice. But that is the story of Egypt. So Egypt was a big problem, big, big problem. It took us a long time to fix, to elevate and change the negativity. But eventually, once we did, the Torah says, that's it. You're done. Move on. Next thing. And we had other issues after that. Unfortunately, we're still in the galus of Rome, called Galut Edom, the galus of Edom of Rome. So we obviously have not fixed that issue yet. But we did fix the issue of Paro. So that's what it is. All right, ladies.
Thank you so much, Eric. Can I you put the recording?
I had a question about, I understand that Parsha starts with Paro and ends with Amalek. And right. I can't think but the obvious connection between beginning and the end of the chapter. And I would love to hear your thoughts and explanation. Thank you, Ryan. Right.
Okay, so as I mentioned, as I started mentioning to you, that we did fix the concept of Paro, which is, what is Paro? Paro is narcissism. You want to boil it down to one word. Paro is narcissism. Paro is, I am the focus. I am the center. The world revolves around me. As opposed to, I am here to serve Hashem. I am here for a greater purpose. In other words, does the world serve me, or do I serve, or do I use the world to serve Hashem? Am I a tool in a process, or am I the end all and the be all? That's the difference between a narcissist and a normal person. So that was
it's
power.
Like Esther Wynne says, there are only two choices you can make. Are you a creator or you a survivor? So you can be in the creator mode when you're actually like helping to make this world a better place, or you're in the survival mode, then after me, I don't care what happens after me. So it's just as long as I can survive.
Okay, I like that. So the question then becomes, okay, we fixed Paro. So the Jewish nation became an Am. And again, I defined Am, it's not my definition, different of Chassidus, as humble. Humble, Am, from the word Gechalim Omemot, coals that are banked coals, humble coals. Whole coals that have a burning fire inside of them and not the fire going all over the place. Meaning coals that have a purpose, that have a function, that understand their place. So being humble, by the way, does not mean being ineffective. It doesn't mean being a shrinking violet, as they say, being somebody who's afraid to speak up. That's not what humility means. Humility means you have an idea and an understanding of your place in the big picture. Not and if you don't fulfill that place, then you're just plain ineffective. You're not humble. So being humble doesn't mean not standing up for yourself, not doing the right thing, not fighting back against injustice, not fighting back, not pushing back against all kinds of other spiritual negativity. It simply means understanding your place, understanding what your purpose is. So the Jewish nation became an Am, which means a humble entity, an entity dedicated to a greater purpose. However, what is worse? What human condition is worse than a narcissist? Right? Just forget about religion. I mean, put religion on the side for a moment. Which human condition is worse than being a narcissist?
Arrogance.
What's that?
Arrogance.
Well, arrogant and narcissist is almost the same.
Same thing.
Almost the same.
What about murder?
No. You know what's worse? What's worse than being a narcissist is having no self-esteem. So a narcissist is a person who says, I need to get out there and accomplish, and I need you to accomplish for me because you have a drive. A narcissist, the big politicians and the big builders, they're all narcissists. I mean, shouldn't say all. It's not nice to say that. I'm sure there are some wonderful people who are not narcissists. But mostly, the big people who are doing big stuff and changing the world in huge ways, positive ways, they're usually narcissists. They're usually people that are self-absorbed and feel that they have this hero complex or everybody has to serve them. Again, not everybody, clearly. There's a lot of good people who don't have that issue. But when you have a person that has no self-esteem, no drive, not sure which way, if I wake up in the morning, does it make a difference or not? Should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? Is it this? Is it right? Is it wrong? Is this? Then unfortunately, then you're just dead. Then you're dead. So Paro didn't have that second issue. He had the first issue. He built Egypt. He used the Jews as slaves. He used the Jews to build his country. And yes, it's true that he was terrible Nazi despot, worse than Hitler, and he mistreated the Jews and he gave them work to do, the Medrash says, that was not important, that was not effective, and would immediately break just because he wanted to break their spirit. But at the end of the day, Paro was just trying to control the people. He was a very bad person, but he was trying to control the people. He was trying to accomplish his purpose, his ends. Amalek, however, is the second problem. Amalek is the people who come and say, what's the difference if you do it or not? Nobody cares. Nobody knows about you. Nobody's going to know about you. You're going to wake up in the morning. Doesn't make a difference if you don't wake up. Doesn't make a difference if you go to sleep in the morning. Doesn't make a difference if you go to work, if you don't go to work. If you raise a family, if you get married, if you don't get married. If you have children, if you don't. Everybody's going to die anyway. Eventually, nobody's going to care. And who needs all this stuff? Is there a God? Is there maybe not a God? Is there a purpose? Is there maybe not? Amalek is doubt, confusion, low self-esteem, no drive, no purpose, no knowledge. Amalek is a very, very, very more pernicious. It's a more difficult, how could you deal with a ghost? You're fighting a ghost. When you're fighting a person that has an agenda, you're fighting a person that has a clear sense of what they want, even though it's bad and wrong, then you can have an argument, you can have a discussion. But if there's nobody home, who are you going to talk to? There's nobody to talk to. So Amalek is, and our sages tell us, Begematria, the Suffolk. Amalek, Ayin Mem Lamed Kuf, same numerical value as Samach Pei Kuf, which is Suffolk doubt. Amalek puts doubt. And in the language of the Chumash, Asher Karcha Baderach, Amalek cooled down the Jewish nation. Amalek said to the Jews, you think Hashem really loves you? You're so excited that God took you out with 10 plagues. It happened. You were in the right place at the right time. There's no God. And if there is a God, you were an accident. And if you're an accident, then it doesn't matter if you do, if you don't do. Amalek didn't tell the Jews, here, worship idols, like the way Paro told the Jews. Amalek told the Jews, you don't matter. You don't matter. It doesn't make a difference whether you do or you don't do. How are you going to fight that? This problem of Amalek is till today. That's why the story of Purim, which is, as you know, the continuation of the fight against Amalek, was a story when the Jewish nation stood up and said, no, we do matter. No, we will not follow Haman's suggestion that we should give up our title as Jews. Haman said to the Jews like this. Haman said, and we're going to celebrate Purim in less than a month. Just about a month, a little more than a month. Just slightly over a month, right? So we can start talking about Purim already. So Haman said to the Jews, I don't want to kill you if you're not a Jew. I'm not Hitler. I'm not looking to kill every biological Jew. I only want to kill Hayehudim, the ones who identify as Jews. If you choose to stop identifying as a Yehudi, as a believer, as a Jew, I don't want to kill you. You will not be subject to my decree. And in fact, every single Jew said, no, we will not sign on to your ideas. We matter. It matters how we think of ourselves. It matters to Hashem, and it matters to us, our title, our self-esteem, our self-view. So Haman told the Jews, what you do in your private house, I could care less. I'm not telling you what to do in your house. Later on, the story of Hanukkah, which is later on, is a different story. And later on, the story of Hanukkah, the king, Antiochus, told the Jews, I don't want you worshiping Hashem. I don't want you to keep Shabbos. I don't want you to have circumcision. I don't want you keeping a Jewish calendar. I don't want you thinking and acting in a Jewish way. Haman never said that in the entire Megillah. There were no decrees issued against the Jewish practice. The Jews had been practicing worshiping for a long time. This is a story between the first and second Beis HaMikdash. We had been Egypt. Well, Egypt was 800 years before the story of Hanukkah. Story of Purim. For 800 years, we had worshiped. Haman never said, stop worshiping. Haman said, I don't like the fact that you're identifying as a Jew in public. You don't matter. It doesn't matter what you do. Don't think of yourself as a special nation. And the Jews did not change their practice, change their labeling of themselves. They didn't change their view of themselves, and therefore they were able to fight against the Amalek, because the Amalek gives you doubt. Amalek says you don't matter. Amalek says it doesn't matter. Nobody cares what you're doing, what you don't do. It makes you happy, do it, but nobody cares about it. That's what Amalek says. So if it makes you happy, it doesn't make you happy, big deal. Amalek is big deal. Big deal. You went to shul. You kept Shabbos. If you don't keep Shabbos, well, now you're a bad person. And you kept kosher. If you don't keep kosher, people don't keep kosher, just as good as people do keep kosher. What's the difference? And Hashem cares. Does God care what you put in your mouth? As long as you're a good person in your heart. Amalek tells us all of these things. So this is the story of the end of the Parsha. So we jump from the frying pan into the fire. And what happened was that from Paro, which is the subjugation of the Jewish action, making us into actual slaves, Amalek crept into our heads. And Amalek said, you're no longer slaves, but you're not really powerful people either. So that's the connection between the beginning and the end of the Parsha, which, of course, we'll talk about more as we get closer to Purim, what actually happened with Mordechai and Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus, these four players during the story of Purim.
If I understood correctly, so Amalek is kind of impersonification of cynicism. So it's like the large cynic, like it doesn't, somebody breeds the doubt, it's a job of a cynic, right?
Exactly right. Amalek is a cynic. Amalek is not Paro was an atheist. Amalek is an agnostic. Paro said, no, I know for sure there's no God. I'm God, as a matter of fact. And Amalek said, I'm not sure. Maybe. And if you do, yeah. And if you don't do, maybe. So how are you going to fight that? It's a cloud. You're fighting a mirage. You're fighting a ghost. The Jews had a big problem with Amalek. You know, big problem with Amalek. Till today.
Thank you, Rabbi.